yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as we indicated at the end of last week's show, for this week and subsequent several weeks, I'm going to be discussing the main themes and conclusions, recommendations from my just-published book, out this month, called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, published by Clarity Press. Interested parties can purchase the book through PayPal on my website or through Clarity Press or on Amazon or other bookstores, since it is shipping now as of this week. And you can find out more information by going to my blog and or my website, blog simply jackrasmus.com. There's an icon there, the book jacket, and that'll take you to the website. If you click on it, and the website will allow you to click on the icon there and go and get some free chapters, introduction, see the extended table of contents, and a couple free chapters there, and take a look at it, okay? Also, I will be teaching a online course with the World Institute, WISC, it's called, by the Zenet Collective. WISC is a very low cost. I think it's $25 to take a course. It's taught by a whole bunch of progressives and radicals, you can jump into that course, and we'll be talking about over next 8 weeks starting in January. Subsequent 8 weeks starting first week of January, we'll be discussing the book, but I'll say more about that as well. Okay, so enough of the information here. And we're going to talk about the early chapters in that book today about why is it that mainstream economics, economists, and the major global research institutions of capitalism today. I'm talking about the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, OECD, central banks, and so forth. Why is it that their forecasts of the economy, global economy, have been consistently over-optimistic? And that's been going on ever since 2008. In fact, they were over-optimistic before the crash. They're always over-optimistic. Why is it that they're always forecasting, predicting a better world than actually turns up? We'll want to talk about that and review their forecasts because they've been wrong, and they're wrong again for next year. And then I want to talk about what I call the dead cat bounce recovery that occurred after 2009. We'll go from there and eventually thereafter do a review of the conditions in the various sectors of the global economy, and then talk about nine key trends that I identify in the book as responsible for the growing fragility and instability in the global economy. We know the global economy is slowing rapidly, especially in China and emerging markets, but also stagnating in Japan and in Europe, and barely growing here in the U.S., and the estimates in the U.S. are really overestimated. We want to talk about those nine major trends. I'll identify what they were, and then we want to do a review of the mainstream economics and why their theories and models no longer work, and therefore they cannot forecast and predict the direction, trajectory of the global economy and keep getting it wrong, and will keep getting it wrong. And then finally, in the last in this series, I'll propose explain some of my own theory of systemic fragility. Fragility being a proxy term for instability. How do we get from fragility? What does that mean? Means it's tending towards greater instability. Instability on the financial side, financial markets, and instability on the real side of the economy, in other words, growth and so forth. So that's the scenario for this current month. But we're going to continue also what I announced a couple of weeks ago, and that is at the beginning of each show. We're going to talk about the major empirical developments of the preceding week. Stories, major economic U.S. and global stories that you need to keep an eye out for because very clearly they're important, and we're going to hear more of them. Okay, what are these of the past week? Well, one thing, last week I spent a little time talking about Japan's fifth recession in 7 years. Since 2008, Japan has been in five recessions. Oh, but Japan just said this past week, oh, no, the last one, no. It didn't really happen, the last one, meaning second quarter and third quarter of this year. And that was from April through September. The data came out and showed that Japan's GDP had contracted significantly in both quarters. Again, the fifth contraction in 7 years. And what happened last week, though, in less than a week from the original data showing a contraction, Japan revised the data and said, oh, no, that was a technical error. We really didn't contract in the third quarter. We actually had a growth. Therefore, we avoided a recession. They simply massaged the numbers and came out with something else. You know, revisions are not untypical in terms of GDP, but you usually have to wait for more data to come in. That's why you revise it. You know, in the U.S., it revises its GDP numbers twice. But, you know, you're looking at 45, 60 days, typically, between the original preliminary numbers and then the revisions. Well, Japan did it in 4 or 5 days. Well, you know, you just don't get enough additional data in order to have a revision of nearly 2% GDP from your initial announcement. And that's what's happened in Japan. Yeah, they announced, oh, we just didn't see all this corporate investment that occurred here last week. So, you know, instead of a minus 0.8% drop in GDP, we actually had a 1% increase in GDP. So, you know, effectively they have a 1.8% GDP shift in less than a week. Well, come on, you know. Somebody's doctoring the numbers over there. But, you know, that's not that infrequent anymore. When it comes to GDP numbers, as I've said on other shows here, they're all playing with GDP now and redefining it and manipulating it and changing it and so forth everywhere globally, you know, as this recovery since 2009 everywhere is pretty weak, has been weak, and now it's in retreat. They're all changing the numbers, the politicians, to make themselves look good. India doubled its GDP. I was talking with an investment fellow from India, and he says, look, you know, we all know this is a joke. This is a joke. You know, India's not growing at 8%. You know, India's barely growing at 4%. And what we do in India, he said, was just have the number. Whatever the government says, we, you know, somewhere around half is really what it is. And Nigeria has had, what, added 3 or 4%, you know, as their economy, because it's an oil economy, collapsed, made the politicians look bad. So just to change the picture, they added 3 or 4% onto it. And, you know, we've talked about Europe, how everywhere they're finding these little adds and changes to GDP, you know, like counting prostitution and drug dealing, right? That adds to GDP. Now they count that. You know? And in the U.S., we redefined GDP investment numbers by counting intangibles, as they call it, intellectual property and intangibles, which are, you know, impossible to estimate in terms of price and volume of goods, services, values, whatever, you know, but they come up with their little models and they add their numbers. Well, that's going on everywhere, but you know, Japan has been pretty blatant. It's getting more blatant over time, you know, and raises the question, you know, you have to take a lot of these numbers with a grain of salt here increasingly. Okay, so that was an event of last week. What's another event? Oh, global oil prices fall below $40 a barrel. We are clearly in a second leg in the downturn of global oil and commodity prices. You know, the first one began in December of 2014, and then stabilized a little bit here over the summer, you know, in the $50 range, but now it's falling clearly below 40. And will continue to fall because the Saudis just had their OPEC meeting last week, and they said, we're not going to change our production level. Production is still increasing of crude oil. And that's because Iran and Iraq are now pumping oil. So what's happening is they are everywhere in the world, oil producers, including the frackers here in the U.S. They're trying to hold on to market share. They're willing to accept a lower price just to maintain their market share, their customers, and so forth, right? And it's in a downward spiral. You know, commodities, and oil in particular, is in a downward debt spiral. And some investment banks have estimated the price could go as low as $20 a barrel. Okay, we've never not had a recession when oil prices have fallen this low, period. Pretty strong indicator, I would say. Oh, but it's not the kind of indicator that economists like and typically use. You know, they got their models with these other relationships between variables and so forth, you know, and a black swan event or a gray swan event, you know, it's coming out of nowhere, as they say, these unanticipated developments, you know, like the collapse of oil, don't factor into their forecasts. And they don't anticipate them, and when they happen, they say, oh, well, okay, you know, maybe it'll have some effect. Then they go back to their old forecast and use these black swan events as a kind of a outlier, you know, the worst case. You know, given this black swan event didn't anticipate, you know, the forecast could be as bad as this. But, you know, basically the forecast is pretty good, is what they continued to say. All right. So that's an interesting development. Oil prices below $40 last week. What's another one here? Oh, a mutual fund made up of junk bonds in the U.S., has gone belly up, essentially. You know, Third Avenue Management, LLC is the name of it, right? And it invested heavily in junk bonds in the energy sector. And, of course, we know the energy sector is in free fall in the U.S., particularly, you know, the fracking gas and oil because of this fight with the Saudis and globally. And these folks have borrowed a lot of money to do all this drilling, and borrowed it in the form of issuing high-yield corporate bonds called junk bonds, right? And these junk bonds now are going bust because these frackers don't have the revenue to pay the interest on these junk bonds that they issued, you see. And because the price has fallen, therefore they don't have the revenue, right? Okay, so Third Avenue Management just announced this past week that it is liquidating its high-yield junk bond fund. Liquidating, in other words, closing it. You know, it's almost $1 billion, right, in that fund. And as it's liquidating it, it's not paying off or not allowing its his investors to cash out. Yeah, he says, okay, tough luck, guys. You know, you're holding junk here, and it's going to collapse, and you're just going to take the loss. You can't get your money out. You know, we're not going to let you take your money out. All right? High-yield junk bond assets at the mutual funds in the U.S., of which this company is, well over $300-400 billion, right? Three times greater. That's just U.S. junk bonds in mutual funds, right? The industry itself, junk bond industry, you know, is trillions of dollars just in the U.S., right? Well, investors are pulling their money out of junk bonds everywhere, you know, and they're in a free fall, and we're beginning to see cracks and defaults occurring. We've had some increasing warnings here about defaults coming. You know, when we have defaults, that means that the asset prices are going to collapse even faster, right? You know, about a fifth of all the junk bonds issued outstanding in the U.S. Are in the energy sector. You know, I mean, the junk bonds, U.S. junk bond market is somewhere between $1.5-2 trillion. So about 20% of that is in the energy sector, which is mostly mining and fracking, oil, gas fracking. And therefore, you know, we could be facing hundreds of billions of dollars of defaults here in the next short term with these fracking energy companies, right? Okay, defaults coming. Watch them. Because that when those defaults begin to spread, it will have a psychological effect on the bond and stock markets. At the same time, the stock market's getting very nervous because of the oil prices have collapsed and are collapsing again. And now the junk bonds defaults will start emerging. And now the Fed's going to raise interest rates. We'll talk about that, too, as a interesting event of the last week. Well, they've been signaling they're going to raise interest rates for some time and not doing it. And we're talking about short-term rates and probably only a quarter of 1%, but that's coming. 97% of the economists here this past week forecast big, you know, big out on a limb forecast, that Federal Reserve will raise interest rates here next week. Next week, so we'll have more to say about it next week. I think it's next Wednesday or Thursday, so we'll have our show. We'll talk a lot about that next week, okay, as well as continue our discussion of systemic fragility, right? It's not going to have that great impact on the U.S. It's already been factored in, markets and so forth, but it will have a big effect, continuing effect, i.e. raising rates. On the rest of the world economies, particularly on emerging market economies, it probably will result in both Europe and Japan holding off on further QEs until they see the effect of the rise in U.S. interest rates on the value of the dollar. The dollar will go up. More money will flow out of the emerging markets. Their currencies will collapse further. The stock and bond markets will follow. Exports will decline. Domestic inflation in those economies will rise. In other words, it's going to be a mess. Trends are already beginning. China will be forced to devalue as well, I predict, as a result of the Fed interest rate rise. Right? It's going to have real havoc, particularly in Latin America, which is already becoming increasingly unstable, right? Politically as well as economically. We see this election that was just held last week in Venezuela, where the right-wingers got control, significant control of the assembly down there. So it's going to be a big catfight between the business interests and the right-wing radicals who did capture a lot of the seats there versus President Maduro and the socialists who have been nationalizing a lot of industries and so forth. Well, you know, the reason why we have this sweep in Venezuela is the economy has been really ravaged lately. A lot of that ravaging, of course, has been with the help of U.S. banking and government interests, which have done everything they could to destabilize the currency of Venezuela. And when you destabilize the currency collapses, and therefore import prices rise significantly. So the cost of living risen significantly because the U.S. has been attacking, with its business friends, attacking the currency. At the same time, you know, Venezuela probably could have survived this attack, as it has in the past from the U.S., but the price of oil collapsed simultaneously. And it relies significantly on oil. Oil sales, Venezuela does, and it can't. Venezuela and others have tried desperately to get Saudi Arabia to go along with reducing the supply, global supply of oil, so the price would rise back up, but Saudi Arabia doesn't want to do that, you see. Saudi Arabia wants to wait it out. It's got deep pockets, although it's using a lot of the money in those pockets, to try to break the back of global fracking in the U.S., oil fracking, oil gas fracking in the U.S., you know, acting like a typical monopoly that they are. And what they're trying to do is drive the U.S. Out of U.S. frackers and drillers out of the market, and they're having some success in that, and that's related, of course, to the junk bond collapse going on in the U.S. The price, collapsing price of oil brings defaults and junk bond problems, but it originates with Saudi Arabia and the decision to take on challengers in the U.S., but Saudi Arabia drags down the rest of the oil producers. Saudi Arabia and its Emirate buddies, of course, together, all in the same boat here. Poor Venezuela has seen its revenue collapse as a result. Okay, Argentina is in trouble, right? Politically, they've had a big fight over there. And, you know, the center-left government of Kirchner has been replaced, again, by a business conservative, pro-Yankee business conservative there, Macri. We've got a lot of turmoil there. And in Brazil, too, they're squeezing out the Workers' Party there. Rousseff, her name is Dilma Rousseff, lost the election. So big turmoil all throughout Latin America, especially in its major economies. Political turmoil and economic turmoil that's going to get much worse very soon here. And that's because of the imminent continued rise in U.S. rates, interest rates, long-term rates continuing to rise, and now short-term. What that does is collapse the currencies of these other countries and sends capital flowing to the north, Europe, and so forth, right? And all the other consequences of that. That's the condition there in emerging markets. That's going to get worse. You see, the locus of the collapse of the crisis is now in emerging markets, including China, right? We'll talk about that shortly here with this dead cat bounce global economy concept here. Okay, so quickly, what other major events of last week? China got an improvement by the International Monetary Fund to use its currency, the yuan, renminbi, whatever you want to call it, got two names, as a global reserve trading currency. This is a big economic victory for China to have its currency right up there alongside, the dollar, the pound, the euro, and the yen as a trading currency. That's going to help China quite a bit. Well, what it's going to do probably in the short run has raised the value of that currency, which China can't afford right now because the global economy is slowing and its economy is slowing rapidly because its exports are declining. So what this means is this approval is that now the yuan will be a global currency, it will be more susceptible to supply and demand forces on its currency, which means it will have to devalue. Not right away, but it will have to devalue. And that means if it comes to devalue, somehow the China currency, the yuan, is going to have to break out of this band of roughly 4% fluctuation against the dollar. If the dollar rises, the yuan, now global currency, has to fall. That currency, will result in a further devaluation, which means the currency wars are well and alive and continuing and will continue. You know, both Japan and Europe bump up their QEs, drive down their currencies. Okay, the U.S. raises interest rates, the dollar goes up, and emerging market currencies go down. And then China follows and devalues the currency because now it's all connected. All connected. Okay, another interesting thing is Yahoo. Remember, the company, the tech company Yahoo in the U.S., right? In trouble for some time. Doesn't really have a differentiated product, competing against some big players, like Google and others. But Yahoo made a good move a few years back. It bought a big part of this China e-commerce company called Alibaba. Alibaba, big company there, kind of like a combined Amazon, Google, whatever, right? And Alibaba's values have risen, of course, and Yahoo's investment in Alibaba has increased significantly as well. But Yahoo's in trouble here in the U.S. and otherwise globally. So Yahoo is trying to figure out how to sell its share of Alibaba. Okay, those shares are worth $32 billion. However, Yahoo does not want to pay Uncle Sam income tax on that, $10 billion in income tax. So they're figuring out a way, a variation on the theme of inversions, tax inversions, we've talked about that on the show, how to bilk Uncle Sam here of the $10 billion. Just another example of all this manipulation by multinational U.S. corporations of the tax code so they can get out of paying anything. And Yahoo is another big example of that going on. Oh, another thing that's developing, is Dow Chemical and in the process of DuPont and Dow. We're going to see how they'll use that merger and acquisition worth $130 billion to avoid paying taxes. Right? And then final note of important development last week is the U.S. Senate is complaining louder about all the pharmaceutical drug companies' price gouging. But they're not doing anything about it, They're making it a big talk-to-talk, but no walk event, right? They're not going to do anything about it in an election year when they need all that money from the drug companies for their re-elections, Oh, they got hearings. They got hearings going on. Senators from Maine, and who is a short termer, is not going to run again. So Collins, I think her name is. So she's has his hearings going in the Senate. She can do it because she doesn't need the money for next time around because she's not running. So she has these hearings. It's just a publicize events like Turing Pharmaceuticals, right? We've talked about them, buy up this company, a drug that was has to do with hepatitis C. No, excuse me, has Daraprim, has to do with infections for women in pregnancies and cancer infections and so forth. You know, they used to, for full treatment, you could get the infection cleared for $1,200 for 3 month treatment. Now, Turing buys this company, and it costs $69,000 to have the treatment. Gouging. And then this other company called Valeant, right, which used to, you know, has this drug it bought that used to cost $440. It's a heart drug that, you know, when you have heart failure or something like that, when you're in emergency or something, you know, it'll save your life for, you know, just a one shot of this stuff. Well, now it's $2,700 for a shot, and that's only a tip of the iceberg of all the things. Anyway, all this is going on everywhere this past week. Okay, so now we want to move on. Let's move on to our topic of choice here, which is starting this discussion of systemic fragility in the global economy. All right, so what do I mean by this, systemic fragility? Well, you know, economists, some of us, are becoming increasingly disenchanted with the direction and the failure of theories, models, and concepts associated with much of mainstream economic analysis. Anomalies have begun to appear in the global economy with increasing frequency in recent decades. What's an anomaly? Anomaly is something that pops out of nowhere. No one has an explanation for it, because your whole conceptual apparatus and your theories and models are based on the past. And an anomaly is something new, unaccounted for, that has happened. And the old theoretical framework was developed off of different conditions and anomalies in the past. Well, here's the new ones, and they keep using the old framework, and they don't adapt it and come up with new theories or new conceptual framework to try to explain the new anomalies. You know, all fields, all disciplines evolve this way. You know, scientific disciplines, not that economics is so scientific, but it does deal with data, so it gives you the impression it is. In any event, anomalies have begun to appear in the global economy with increasing frequency, but they've been unanswered by most of mainstream contemporary economics. Some of these anomalies aren't even addressed. Well, what are some of them? Some of them, right? And this is the start point for my book, Systemic Fragility. In other words, try to develop a new conceptual framework that better explains these anomalies, because if you don't explain them, you can't predict what they're going to do and therefore where the economy is going. And mainstream economics is doing a very poor job, again, of predicting where the global economy is going. They can't succeed in doing that because they don't have the conceptual apparatus for doing that. You know, a lot of the concepts and theories have become ideological. In other words, they're not really based upon observation anymore. They are created, ideas that are created to justify the interests of certain people who have a lot of money. So, you know, economics is kind of a mix of this. There's part scientific reality and analysis and observations, and part ideological obfuscation overlaid on top of this. And over time, the obfuscation and ideology gains greater weight. And, of course, then you can't explain the anomalies as time goes on. So what are some of these anomalies that the old ideological-laden mainstream conceptual apparatus of economics is failing to even address, let alone explain? Well, here's some. One, more than $20 trillion, maybe $25 trillion, in global central bank liquidity has been injected into the global economy since 2008. This is, of course, not just QE, but, you know, zero interest rates, special auctions, all this kind of stuff. More than $20 trillion. Now, according to their economic theory, all that money injection should be resulting in inflation in goods and services. You know, they say, a whole certain wing of economists, I call them retroclassicalists because they try to turn the clock back to Adam Smith. Retroclassicalists say that, oh, you know, inflation is a result of too much money chasing too few goods. So if you're injecting all this extra money, tens of trillions of dollars, it should result in inflation in goods and services prices. But it's not. In fact, just the opposite is happening. Goods, products, in other words, prices globally have been slowly disinflating. Not inflating, but disinflating. Well, what's disinflating? That's the rate of increase in inflation is slowing. And when it hits zero and goes negative, we call that deflation. So the norm is disinflation and the drift towards deflation in goods prices, even though we have this massive increase in money that has occurred. And yet we have these high-paid professional academic economists running around still spouting this nonsense, you know, that all this liquidity injection and so forth, money supply, is going to result in inflation. It's like, you know, that play Waiting for Godot, you know, that great French play by Samuel Beckett in the 1960s, or maybe it was a decade earlier, I don't know. A great play, and they keep waiting for Godot, this guy who's supposed to show up. Godot never shows up, you know? And they're sitting there on stage, these two guys in their garbage cans, and they're waiting for Godot. It's only a two-man play, but fascinating play. But Godot, no one knows who is Godot. You know, well, Godot is inflation for these economists and goods inflation, but Godot never shows up. All right, that's an anomaly. Okay, what's another one? After 7 years of near zero and even negative interest rates by central banks, right, trillions of dollars in corporate debt issuance, in other words, corporations issuing bonds, you know, and gathering all of that money, right? And trillions of dollars in equity stock value appreciation, and trillions in record corporate profits and corporate cash hoarding, and payouts of trillions more to shareholders and stock buybacks and dividend payouts since 2008. Despite all of this, real investment continues to slow. Real investment meaning investing in real things, right? To build things for people, right? And goods, products, real investment that requires hiring people, right? Which means they get an income. They're no longer unemployed, which means, they have an income, therefore they can now spend more on consumption that boosts the economy. It's been spending in the economy and consumption's, you know, like 70% of the economy in the U.S. Okay, so you need jobs, you need income, you need people to buy, you need jobs to do that, and the jobs, you know, have to be making things. And they got all this money to make things, they, corporations, but they're not making them. In other words, they can borrow money at almost zero interest rates. Doesn't cost them anything to borrow money to invest, but they're not. Right. They issue trillions of dollars of corporate bonds to get more money. They don't borrow it. You know, you can borrow from the banks of interest rates, or you can issue corporate bonds and get money that way if you're a company. Or you can issue new stock, equity valuation, and stock prices are going up, so lots of money that way. Right. And they're sitting on record corporate profits, record cash hoards, paid out about $7 trillion just in the U.S. to Europe, Japan, to shareholders. And they're still sitting on another $7 trillion in cash, these big corporations. In other words, they're just awash. They're just awash in all this money that they're supposed to, according to economic theory, now have all this to invest. Ah, but they're in making real things, but they're not doing that. Well, that's an anomaly. Well, what they are doing with it is plowing it back into financial assets, which is the main theme of my book, right? And, of course, the question is then, why? Why are they plowing it into financial assets rather than into real investment? Why into financial asset investment instead of real investment? Well, that's an important question. That mainstream economics is not all that interested in, it appears. Okay, that's an anomaly. All that money and no investment. Here's another one. After $9 trillion of just quantitative easing, QE, provided by central banks, you know, that's where QE just, I mean, central banks just pump the money in into the economy directly by buying up bonds from investors and buying up equities even and everything else in Japan, by the way. And that's where all these central banks are going. You know, they're just propping up all these financial asset markets, even though they don't need propping, by injecting all this money into them, right? Okay, despite all this quantitative easing by the central banks, you know, in which they pump all this money into the private banks are still sitting on more than $5 trillion in non-performing bank loans. $5 trillion. That's in the AE, advanced economies in China. On their bank, private bank balance sheets, they still have $5 trillion non-performing loans. Even though, you know, central banks are giving them $9 trillion. Right? And that's not counting. We don't know. I don't know what to... how much of these non-performing loans exist in emerging markets. This is just the advanced economies of Europe, Japan, U.S., and China. Non-performing loans. Bank non-performing loans. Wow. Now, just think, where's all this money going, you know? It's not going in the right places. Where's it going? Well, in the book I say it's being absorbed by the new finance capital elite. You know, there's this growing number of super wealthy people around the world, professional investors. I call them the new finance capital elite. You know, high net worth, very high net, ultra high net worth individual investors. You know, these are the guys who really are behind the hedge funds and so forth, private equity firms, shadow banks. You know, they either own them or are closely allied with them and so forth. And there's 200,000 of them around the world have most of the wealth and assets, you see. We need more analysis of that. We need to know, who are these people? How did they get this way? What are they doing? Who do they? What institutions do they control? You know, we got to shine the light on this and figure out what the hell's going on. Let's stop talking about the markets. The markets? As if they were a person, you know, the market said today, you hear on these business shows, the market said today, well, the markets don't exist. It's investors, it's real people, agents behind these things that are, quote, the markets. Yeah, there's massive individual investors, you know, and a lot of small stock and so forth, but I'm not talking about, you know, basic Dow Jones stock. I'm talking about the real money where it's really made. You know, and these other liquid financial asset markets by the new finance capital elite through their preferred institutions, the shadow banks, unregulated, global. Right? Okay. Here's another anomaly. Right? Total global debt levels continue to surge well beyond their 2008 levels. In other words, the financial crash, which has caused in part significantly by excess debt, primarily on the corporate side, private corporate side. You see, government debt is a consequence of bailing out the excess debt on the business side. And yes, individual households, their debt levels are growing, but that's because of their wages are not growing, and they're resorting to debt to finance their standard of living. Right? But that's a different animal than the corporate debt, you see. Corporate debt is borrowed to speculate to make more profits, particularly on the financial side. Well, since 2008, you would have thought that some of this would have been written off, right? That some of this debt would be expunged with the losses that occurred. Well, truth is, even a year ago, the reports were, I don't know how much more than additional $40 trillion in total global debt has been added. $40 trillion since 2009. $40 trillion additional debt? Is this government debt and deficit? No, it's, you know, government debt has risen in the advanced economy some as they subsidized and bailed out investors. And it hasn't risen much, hardly at all, for households. Right? It was rising before then, but it hasn't risen for households. Where the big increase in debt has occurred globally is in emerging markets and in corporate debt in emerging markets. That's where, you know, over $20 trillion has been added just in 5 years. Okay, what does that mean? That means they borrowed a lot of money. Businesses in emerging markets borrowed a lot of money from global investors, right? Where did the global investors get it that they loaned it? Oh, they got it from the Fed and the banks. Borrowed from the Fed, zero interest rates, reinvested, mostly in emerging markets. And now the emerging markets are full of this junk, full of this debt, and their currencies and economies are collapsing. They won't be able to pay the debt, and they're going to default. You see, the next crisis is coming out of the emerging markets. You know, it's not coming out of subprime mortgages. Although there are signs of significant weaknesses in the financial systems here in North America and Europe as well. You know, we talked about one. One was the corporate junk debt, right? There's others as well, like exchange-traded funds and leveraged buyouts, leveraged loans. You know, those are in trouble. And liquidity for the repo, repurchase agreements markets. You know, there are these signs here and there as well. It's not, you know, there are fracturing beneath the system going in advanced economies. But the big problem is in the corporate debt in emerging markets, including China. And this is where the next crash is coming. And it will emanate everywhere, right? Usually these crises come out of nowhere, or they appear to come out of nowhere, because the economists are looking nowhere. They can't see, because their theories and models don't shine a light on the new anomalies, right? Okay, so global debt levels surging, new anomaly. Another is chronic collapse of global oil and commodities have had virtually no effect on household spending. You know, about a year ago, they're all talking when the oil price collapse started to gain momentum. Oh, you know, this is going to be good for us. You know, economists in the media were saying, and I was saying, no, it's not going to have any effect. You know, the declining price of gasoline is either going to be used to pay down debt by, you know, the wealthier middle-class households, right? Or it's going to be siphoned off into paying for rising rents, rising education costs, and rising health care costs. Yeah, we're going to pay more for health care under Obama. And that's exactly what happened. You know, a lot of people started buying health insurance that couldn't afford it. Well, you know, a lot of that savings went elsewhere. It got absorbed elsewhere, which means it was no net increase, positive impact on the U.S. economy. Now, so all this global oil and commodity prices have had no effect on consumption. It's had a negative effect on investment. We talked about that already, right? Meanwhile, wage income gains in the advanced economies have been stagnating despite 7 years of official recovery. There's been no wage increases, real wage increases going on here. You know, they talk a lot about raising minimum wages and so forth, but you know, it's the wages of the median, of the middle class, that are stagnant and declining. The middle class is being hollowed out in the U.S. You know, there's a few of them who are moving up, a lot of them moving down. People at the top stay at the top. People at the bottom stay at the bottom. And now we got movement. We got we got income migration going on here. Income immigration, right? Middle class moving down. Okay. Despite, you know, deficit spending and trillions of dollars in the advanced economies, we still have a historically subnormal recovery since 2009, which is running out of steam, right? And the recovery we had in China emerging markets for a few years between 2010 and 13 has been slowing rapidly since 2014 and will continue. Well, how do the economists explain this? They don't very well, if at all, right? We also have this phenomenon going on in the U.S. of a shift to contingent and now gig economy employment. Contingent meaning part-time temp contract work, right? That's been going on for a couple decades now, lowering the wages of folks, eliminating any semblance of job security, and removing any kind of benefits, because contingent part-time temp workers don't get any benefits, don't get paid as much, and lose their jobs or have more time off in between jobs, right? So wages decline. Contingency trend has a lot to do with why we have wage stagnation in the U.S., and that's where most of the job creation has occurred, with contingent employment, you know, retail and lodging and so forth, right? That's where most of it is. Yeah, there have been some few professional jobs and so forth, but, you know, not that much in manufacturing or construction, which tend to pay more. You know, they talk about, oh, we created 800,000 manufacturing jobs in the U.S. since 2009. Well, we lost 1.5 million, so we only had halfway there, right? And you're never going to see that other half. Construction, the same, even worse. Right. So what do you got? You got a lot of contingent jobs, low-paid, service kind of jobs, and they're for low wages. And now we got this new phenomenon being overlaid on top of this called the gig economy, sometimes sharing economy, right? Uber, the Uberization of the U.S. economy, which is going to have an impact on service jobs the way offshoring and manufacturing jobs had on manufacturing employment. Okay, it's going to be massive. It's going to really gut the hell out of wage gains. Okay, well, you know, that's where creating jobs at the same time millions are leaving the labor force. They don't know why. Now, it's because people look at this and say, I can't survive with this. Right? We have a chronic problem of both quantity and quality of job creation in North America, U.S., as well as Europe and Japan, because this is a phenomenon that's, you know, the contingency phenomenon is similar elsewhere. You know, the vast majority of jobs created that have been created in Europe have been contingent jobs. You know, like in Italy, 70% of all the jobs created since the last crisis have been part-time temp jobs. Right? Okay. At the same time, you know, another anomaly, financial asset bubbles and busts are reappearing and developing beneath the surface with more frequency once again, despite all the financial bank regulation initiatives since 2009, which are being rolled back now. Fight going on in the Congress and in the UK and in Geneva to roll back even these tepid regulatory initiatives at a time when the financial economy is growing more financially fragile. We're going to talk about what we mean by this fragility. Well, before that, let me just say that since 2009, you know, we've had the weakest global recovery on record, even including a brief surge in growth in China and emerging markets between 2010 and 13. But that now, as I said before, is turning down. China's real economy is slowing rapidly. I have a chapter in my book just on China. called Bubbles, Bubbles, Debt and Troubles, right? And a chapter on Europe, Europe's chronic stagnation, and a chapter on Japan, Japan's perpetual recession for 25 years now, in and out, countless times of recession. And emerging markets, perfect storm. These are all chapters in part one of the book. But even before that, I have a chapter called The Dead Cat Bounce Recovery. Dead cat. You know, you ever hear that term, dead cat bounce? They use it in traders and stock markets use it all the time, dead cat bounce. That's when you have a collapse in stock prices, and then all of a sudden it looks like it's all recovering. It bounces back up, you know, but it's a false recovery, and it collapses once again. It's a dead cat bounce. It comes from this very graphic metaphor, you know, of sometimes an animal will die, and all of a sudden it revives, it jumps up, it runs around, and then it flops again. You know, I remember one time walking, and this squirrel fell off this roof, you know, and right in front of me, and the squirrel crashed right on the ground. And I said, "Oh God, that poor thing! He's a dunner. He's gone, you know. Look at him." And all of a sudden, the guy jumps up, full of energy, runs around in the circle, runs a little way, and then flops again. That was, well, I guess that's a dead squirrel bounce recovery, right? Well, it's a phenomenon in nature, right? And that's exactly what happened to the global economy. You know, in 2008-09, everybody crashed financially. Everything, all the credit dried up everywhere. All the credit markets froze. So everywhere, economies collapsed. But what happened was, in China, unlike the rest of the global economy, China initiated a massive fiscal stimulus of direct government investment in the economy. It was a fiscal driven, not a central bank monetary policy driven, and it was massive. It was like 15% of GDP equivalent, and China quickly recovered. And because China, you know, manufacturing at the time based, needed lots of commodities, it stimulated the commodity demand in Brazil and places like that, right? And oil and iron ore and all the other metals and so forth, right? And dragged out of the hole some of these emerging market economies along with it. And at the same time, you know, as we described, the central banks and vast economies were pumping all this money into their banks and their investors, who turned around and said, "Oh, wow, there's a big demand down here in Latin America and China and so forth," and the money flowed out of the U.S. That's why we didn't get a recovery here right away. And part of the money flowed into other financial assets, right? That's where it went. And part of it they just sat on and continued to sit on, but some of it went into emerging markets. So we had this dual thing, you know, with China, big stimulus, fiscal stimulus, and all the money flowing into emerging markets, and that brought up China and emerging markets significantly. And their, you know, economies are growing 5-10%. China growing 12-14% there for a while. This is all between 2009 and 2012. This is the dead cat bounce, you see. And it mitigated the global decline. We would have been in a depression, global depression, no doubt. Right. It's not that the central bank, the Fed, kept us from a depression. No, no. China's fiscal stimulus and emerging market stimulus kept us, the global economy, from a depression. And then the dead cat bounced. Well, we'll talk about that more next week. What happened after 2014? Join us.